So I just want to summarize the panel so far. So I'm going to not be tenured unless I get 6 years industrial experience. My students are going to live with me. They have to work in a different area. I'm just trying to see whether... Sounds great, no problem.
Think about it, you know, I heard Ravi say that they've hired so many people. Yes, that's true, of course, obviously. But what happens next year when there's a freeze in Dallas?
They break up into two more.
This is not a solution. The fact that Lucent seems to be hiding at the moment may have nothing to do with computer science. Absolutely nothing at all. You know, there is no, this is not a cause and effect relationship here. You get a degree in computer science, you'll get a job in Lucent. Maybe, maybe not.
Since one of the basic problems that was posed was there seems to be more PhDs being produced than what the country is able to solve. Now, it doesn't look like that they may have to address that question. What should we do about it? There are more PhDs than needed. So what is the solution to avoid that problem?
I don't think you should stop producing PhDs, you should just produce better PhDs. And let the law of natural selection take its course, and I'm proposing a constructive solution to that problem, that I think that if we stop producing PhDs with the same technical sort of idea that we had 5 or 10 years ago when we did our own PhD, we would have a better chance of producing people who actually are doing something different and new.
I think
I had a different question. I've heard some of the sentiments expressed before on this issue that is, people want a PhD to show that the receiver, the recipient, understands how to frame a research problem and work their way through a research problem, and that she can reach some kind of solution and write it up in a cogent style. So there's some sort of depth knowledge there. But then industrial people seem to also want this breadth idea. Somehow the person shouldn't just know what their PhD is about, but should have some breadth. So I would like to hear the panelists address the question, how are we supposed to educate these people, and what is the time frame that they envision for gaining that sort of breadth and depth in the PhD program?
Let me take a crack at this, since we're discussing this very question at Columbia in terms of the design of our PhD degrees, recognizing the fact that most graduates will not get a job like your advisors. And we can design breadth into the curriculum, and we are designing breadth into the curriculum, starting off with what kind of qualifying or preliminary examinations or what kind of material a student should know in order to consider him or herself a PhD in computer science. And I think most schools have some breadth requirements, but I think these breadth requirements are going to become increasingly important in terms of knowledge. Another thing I've noticed is that students from the top schools tend to do interesting projects during the summer that are often unrelated to their PhD thesis, and I think that's going to become even more important for the future. When I was at Bell Labs in Belcourt, I noticed that the students who had done 3 or 4 projects during the course of their PhD degree. One of them was their PhD thesis, but the other 2 or 3 were things that they had done either in the university or working with industry. These were the students that were startling, because whenever they went into someone's office as part of the interview, they could talk meaningfully about whatever that person was working on. And those were the students that tended to get the offers. So one could also take Mark's more radical proposal of saying that maybe we ought to look at more of a collaboration between industry and academia. In fact, I noticed everyone on this panel has said that. Maybe Dick, but even Dick has an association with industry, have had some association with academia and some association with industry. And I think that may become more of the norm. There's a very interesting report that was written by Brooks and Sutherland, who are the co-editors of this report, and it was a response to the government's criticism of the HPC program that the research community had embarked on. And what this report did was look at a couple of dozen multi-billion dollar a year industries today and looked at where the ideas that created these multi-billion dollar a year industries came from. So one of the industries was workstations. So where were workstations invented? What was the interplay of ideas that caused workstations to become such a big commercial product? And for every one of these new computer or information technology companies, they noticed that there was an interplay of ideas between academia and research, research labs, industrial research labs. So in some cases, the ideas may have initially been invented by somebody in an industrial research lab, but then it had a gestation period in academia, like Unix is a very good example of that. In other cases, an idea was invented by an academic researcher and then picked up by an industrial research lab, and it was re-nourished by academia, and then finally appeared on the marketplace. So I think, particularly for the area of computing and information technology, this isn't a bad model. And being able to train students or educate students so they can function in this kind of environment will be one answer to what will PhDs in the future do. And you'll have a much more fluid career, perhaps, but there certainly will be exciting opportunities for people who can cope in this kind of environment.
I just want to maybe follow up, Mark. I think this breadth is a really important problem. I think we talk a lot also at Princeton about this. I think we do a really lousy job at this, frankly. At Princeton and probably everywhere else, students tend to get pretty narrow pretty quickly. They don't go to talks. The title somehow doesn't, overlap 50% with the title of their thesis. They're very narrow, and I think it's a real shame. And I think we've also seen this on the qualifier exam. I have one story I'd like to share with you. One year we were grading our exam, and we of course have a theory component, and there's a system component, there are other components. And I suddenly noticed the following. There was a theory question about depth-first search, which is, certain kind of graph algorithms that are important. And there was a system question about garbage collection. They had the same answer. Literally, the same exact answer. Of course, in one you have to talk about depth-first search trees, the other one you have to talk about something like garbage collection. So you have to change the terminology slightly. Now, we had, 10 students taking it. The five theory students, guess which one they got right? 0 points on the other question, and the five system, exactly. It wasn't funny, but it is. I finally said to my colleagues who were grading the exams, this is bizarre. We all go, oh, this is pretty interesting. And it was really, it's a shame. But I think students, one of the disservices, I don't know how to teach students, I don't know if anyone here has a better plan. When you get a problem, it's not labeled systems in the real world. It's not labeled, theory. The problems just come to you. I've told my colleagues, I think we should have a multi-day exam, and we should shuffle the questions. And on day one, you should get 10 questions or four or whatever. And maybe some are theory and some are systems, and you should figure it out, because that's part of the thing. And I'm sure in Mark's lab or anyone else's, when, someone comes in with an interesting puzzle or question about designing a new system, it's not labeled, queuing theory applied, here. That's just not the way it works. And I think we don't do a very good job at that. I think we need to work harder, and it's important that the students are deep in one area to prove they can get deep in the area, because, as I said earlier, the areas are going to change, and they have to demonstrate that. But they sure have to have some ability to at least know a lot about a lot of different things. And I think we just don't do a good job at that.
I'll put that into a slogan. The academia, you're down in academia making broad. In industry, we know how to make it deep. We'll do that. We'll narrow the students down for you. But you need to give us broad students who can do that.
I just wanted to mention also, I think the point you were making about the hiring we have done not being a full story is right. Because I gave you the statistics on how many people I didn't tell you how many dinners we had with candidates. And how many candidates we got. Because, and there were days when there were three candidates. I'm trying to keep them from running into each other. What it boils down to is we were very selective, and selectivity was based a lot on threat, as you have been. And one way of thinking about it is that we've seen people who have learned a technique, and they're going around the world looking for problems they can solve with that technique. Everything looks like a nail for the person who has a hammer. The problems we get in industry don't come labeled, as you were saying. Okay? And there are times when you have to develop techniques to solve those problems. So it's not entirely just knowing a lot of areas. It's also, what is your viewpoint? How receptive are you at being able to look at the problem that's being posed and then not get stuck in, well, I'm good at this sort of thing, or I do XYZ, and I'm going to solve that portion of the problem. You know, you solve the whole problem.
And
so,
what problem I see?
I'm sorry, there's... Yeah, he's raising his hand for a long time.
Okay. I was like those questions, at least in light of what I heard here. One is that maybe you can consider a need to have an internship for PhD students as part of the requirements of their PhD, because then it gets exposed to industry, and the industry gets exposed to you, and then also I'm very sad that this is going to make the solutions between you and the team academia and the industry more close. And the other thing is, I'm not sure about this example, but somebody that has a better idea and he introducing the students that they have the same bad idea. I mean, the fact that somebody finished his PhD and he is a doctor, it doesn't necessarily mean that he can also train other people. Doctors, I mean, I guess...
But it happens in computer science all the time, right?
But is it good? I'm not sure
that... I'm not sure that's good, I mean.
All the work.
No, here's the answer, you know. You think about it. We've hired many people, actually a lot from Rutgers itself, over the last few years. Many of them who come with a PhD degree have a great reluctance to work on something other than what they were working on in the PhD. Somehow, getting a degree in, let's say, you know, topic X, gives them the moral right to sort of work on topic X for the next 3 years. This is actually bad, because topic X may have nothing to do with what Lucent or Belcour or Bell Labs has as its main goal of business. So this goes back to what Barbara was saying is, you may have the depth, but you have a great reluctance to work on something else for some strange and bizarre reason, because you think that you spent 3 years trying to get a PhD degree. Therefore, you now must spend the next 5 years on the same topic for good or for bad. We don't. But normally, people won't tell you this when you first hire them.
Yeah, I think it's a totally different position. I don't think there's anything wrong with the system. We can make a pretty strong argument. There is how many unemployed PhDs are there around? I think very few. It's not a risky kind of thing to do if, from the job security point of view. What are people doing? I suspect most are actually working in the field. If there isn't an academic job or an existing research lab job, maybe they go off and start their own company.
Most of them actually end up on Wall Street doing a little bit of programming.
But overall, I don't think it's an unhealthy fit. And that's a good thing. I don't think any of us are in a position to do anything about it anyway. Universities are, as we heard today, and I think most other universities are all trying to jockey for position, make it more attractive for students to come there, expand their programs in the area. The only way at least this would be stopped would be if research funds are completely cut off. And since those come from different places, which are also trying to feed their influence, that's not likely to happen either.
cost sharing of it, I think there is a, the time costs are huge. In the 80s, people went into investment banking, that was a hot thing to do, and computer science enrollments dried up. And so maybe 7 or 8 years later, there might have been a shortage of computer science PhDs. Now there seems to be a lot of people in computer science, and maybe we really will have a problem, I don't know. But that's a sort of separate issue. I'm not sure, but go back to the key thing. I'm not really sure there's a problem. The market forces may take a while to balance things out, but there's value, I think, to the PhD in part. It's related to what Mark said about being somewhat crazy. In order to get through a PhD, you do have to solve a number of problems, only one portion of which is actually the technical one. It requires some sort of resourcefulness, and I think that's probably a useful life skill, both the persistence, the ability to do a project, something which has a kind of coherence carried to completion. It involves writing also, which is really rather different from the research. Fairly reasonable training for any range of things, not just research.
Any more?
I discussed a lot of problems in the professor at university, having a need to find good students who work with you. Especially like research places like Xerox or the labs, who hire people to do research with. At university, if you want to carry your research, you're looking for students to collaborate with you. So this is the source for expanding your whatever, you know, research choices or from one area to another. So you look for PhD students who work with you and introduce PhD students who in turn will become professors, and you can't stop this machinery. This is how the academia was defined originally and will not change.
This was not the way academia was defined originally. This is a recent invention in the last 60 or 70 years or so. I think Heidelberg University was the first one in 1912 that first sort of promulgated the idea of university professors doing research as a part of the official job description. Well, yeah, it's a fact now, but this is not the way it has always been.
So you can change and go back to the original
idea?
No, I
think
what do we do?
When most people do the PhD, they don't have 6 students working for that. So why do you need 6 students after the PhD to do your work with it?
I don't
think
this is a statistical innovation between a number of PhD.
Well, there is a big change that has taken place, and that is the Cold War has ended. And a lot of American research was fueled by the rubric of national security. Now, what replaces national security as the rubric for people wanting to fund research?
Entertainment.
And
government funding is coming from.
Government funding for research is going to go down. So I think for universities to be interesting, you have to have those are collaborations with industry, and then that requires a different kind of activity than I think we had before.
It's the funding is going to be coming from the TV people and the film people and the Hollywood people. This is where the funding is coming from now, largely, and where it's going to come from in the future. This changes the ballgame.
Just to respond to the previous remark, I submit that getting a student working on a problem so you can run a paper, this is the best of academia, is, I understand that that's what happens, but I don't believe that that's the best motivation for having students. And you're not necessarily doing the students a service. I think that it's important for your sake, as well as the students, to have well-motivated problems that people are working on. And if the problems, the remarks about bread that we apply to people we hire, I believe that those are good things to aspire for. In all research.
And so I wanted to respond to what David said just a second ago. It's not the case that PhDs can't find jobs. Yes, they can, but a lot of PhDs aren't really doing research jobs.
No, that was a question.
Yeah, that's exactly. Sorry, that's exactly what I was going to follow up on. That's a good segue into this. I think what one thing that needs to happen is that there needs to be it needs to be made clearer to students entering the PhD process at this point that the world has changed. Now, I just graduated, so I entered 7 years ago, and what I was told at that time is the only reason you should be doing PhD. The only reason you should be in a PhD program is if you anticipate doing research at a university level. That's really the only thing. Otherwise, you should be getting a master's degree. I think in light of the panel and other things that I've read, clearly something has changed, but I'm not sure that message has been has yet made it out throughout the field to graduate students. There may be many things now that PhDs do that were not once considered to be jobs that PhDs ought to be doing, and or things that were something that you should not necessarily aspire to. So I think it's true that there are jobs out there, but I think that we need to rethink what a PhD is going to be doing in the marketplace today.
Well, roughly a few minutes ago, that Lee has noticed that the research cycle, research to development cycle, has gone from something like 30 years to actually 2 or 3 years. But I think it's much more than that. It's down to a few months. If you look at the world of the internet and the web, you find people having an idea, getting venture capital money within 48 hours, and within 3 months having their beta somewhere on our website.
In 6 months, they've gone public and they're millionaires, and they retire and endow a chair.
On the other hand, I have friends who sit around writing a paper for Sigma for 2 months. You know, this is crazy. This is utterly crazy.
So how many of those who brought up the system, data system, have PhDs?
Who cares? Who cares? No.
Yes, sir. Well, yeah,
Probably didn't.
I want to give some proper students. I'm sorry.
I was going to suggest one question, I saw one of the problems with this application in the market field. So, it's a little way to. I know a lot of people who have a master's, a PhD, a degree in other fields. Biology, chemistry, or physics. It is a good way to recruit more kind of people into undergrad, a graduate program in computer science. Anyway, so these people already know the problem of that, or know that what the computer science wants to have is.
One of the motivations in Washington right now is to encourage interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary research. The theory is that there are some problems that require skills from different areas and are too big for a single individual or a single area to make progress in. And one of the areas that computer scientists have actively been involved in is the area of genomics, molecular biology. And there I see some very fruitful collaborations between computer scientists and biologists starting to be established, and my hope for this arena would be that computer scientists working with a biologist will win a Nobel Prize for work that either could not do by himself. And there are other areas in which computer science, I think, could also be perceived in an equal partnership role. However, to make progress in this arena, we need computer scientists who are all annoyed with their respective focus. Computer scientists, and then can also hold their own and be respected as scientists in the other professions. I haven't seen this kind of breadth in computer science as much as I'd like to. The physicists, on the other hand, we should have no problem of saying, well, we can solve problems in any discipline that we work on, and in some cases, it may render significant contributions to computer science and other disciplines. visible. So again, this issue of bread comes in. But getting a PhD in this kind of multidisciplinary activity has the problem that where do you get a job? If you do a job in computational biology, you then get a job in the computer science department or in the biology department. So I would strongly recommend people to have very strong PhDs in this area so they can be endured by both the biologists and the computer scientists.
I think it's a very dangerous
thing. The practical matter of this is that the drug companies are snapping these people up left and right.
Actually, it's very strange because it's always. It is quite easy, in fact, to do a if you're doing a multi-discipline program, simply fall in the cracks, and you end up doing neither. So you're neither a computer scientist nor a pharmacist. And you, when you're, I actually had this sort of experience. I was listening to a talk given by a friend of mine in what used to be Bell Labs, and I didn't understand the talk. And I went up to the speaker afterwards, and he said, "Well, Sunil, you don't understand the talk because you're not a linguist." So I said, "Okay, fine. Thank you very much." And a few months later, he gave the same talk, and there was a linguist in the audience, and I asked him to go and ask him what he had. And he said, "Oh, Ken Church, you don't understand because you're not a database person." So, you know, it's very easy to fall in this crack. That's what you have to watch out for. Multidisciplinary is very hard to do.
Well, I just want to add that my remarks about breath were not really that I was hoping that people would have biology and computer science. It really was that even within a given area, even say within databases or within networking, having an understanding of how does my work fit into the whole. It's like a fisheye lens. You know, if you've seen pictures with fisheye lenses, wherever the focus is seems to be very large and the rest recedes into the distance. And when you spend a long time working on a specific problem, that problem can often take on a life of its own. And it's important to have perspective on where your work fits in.
The question I have is to bring a little bit back to focus the original question that Thomas was asking regarding the New York Times article. I sympathize a lot with the points you're raising about thesis being sometimes pursuing that idea further, and in fact, the number of pressures in finishing a PhD in time and so forth, and sometimes forcing going in that direction. But what I do not understand is the following. Why is it given as a underlying assumption to this discussion that it's only to be one type of professional degree or PhD degree? Why not two types of degrees, one which would be something in between a master's and a PhD as currently conceived, which would not have a thesis option, which would have maybe an industrial internship component, while we still would have a separate, and we say we are not in the science department, mathematics department, but the same kind of issues arise in the other department, why not having a path that does lead to avant-garde research, and we do need people, obviously, that are willing to go into far-out ideas, and who are willing to spend the 7 or whatever number of years doing work to do something really significant, but also have another path, another career option, maybe a 3-year degree, where you would be producing the kind of people that, that for instance, are needed in some of these research laboratories. And the question is two parts. Number one, is that a feasible thing to do? And number two, if you have the second kind of degree, how exactly do you make these people that are going to do that, through what exact mechanism do you make them learn, for instance, how to communicate? Which is something that you achieve through research and presentation, but you do not through standard taking of courses. So.
Just to add to this, I mean, I think that, you know, that the requirement of breadth, again, would probably extend farther the time to do a PhD. I mean, we are constantly facing this question. You know, for example, you know, if we let students start on research early, they focus early, they finish early. If we say, well, breadth is important, take more courses, you know, expand, of course, it takes longer time to do a PhD. So I would second Eduardo that in a way what you're talking about is if you need breadth, I mean, it seems to call for a non-thesis degree which would respond to essentially breadth, you know, better education, you know, professional degree. If you look for a research job, that's called for a PhD thesis.
Well, there are two degrees. One is called the MPhil and one is called the DSc. Right? Both don't require a thesis to be written.
Mike Trevor.
Yes, I had lost the thread of the argument earlier, I just might clarify. Was mentioned that spending too much writing Siglock paper is crazy. Can you explain that?
No, I didn't say it, that writing it was crazy, but I said that the world in which in 2 months you can go from taking an idea all the way to perhaps a successful launch of a new multi-million dollar company and spending 2 months writing a Sigmoid paper, this world is totally crazy.
So,
no, I'm not passing any value judgment on this or that. I'm simply saying that these are two worlds, and look at how crazy this world is, that you can go and operate in this world.
Right.
No. But I have the same one paper which I've been working on. And I think that Michael Fredman is on the program committee, so I don't know.
Tim, I want to respond to the question that was being raised, the remark about a non-thesis degree where you spent 3 years. I'm not sure I see that much difference between spending 3 years and taking a few more courses and having picked up more information at your fingertips and getting a master's and getting a job and spending that same year working on some different projects and picking up the background that you need and the breadth that you need. So if you're going to do away with the thesis, why not start with a master's?
Question here?
Actually, there is plenty of examples of educational systems. That's me?
No, yes, sir.
Yeah, so. So I'll kind of combine these remarks about getting rid of a degree or not. Look at the European academic and high school systems, in particular, say, in countries like Germany or France. The division into those who can graduate higher or those who are kind of destined for vocational market begins very early, sometimes at age 12. Is Europe any better off? I don't know, but there is a comparison. I think that this openness that if you start a graduate program, you can get your PhD if you want to, makes America much more dynamic. You know. So I have no problem with having a degree. After all, it's a student who's waiting 7 years. You're not going to do anything with it. But nobody's problem. The second thing is, one sentence more. Second thing is, I'm sort of surprised that there is a problem with graduates going to Wall Street or something. Hey, they are making 100 grand and they are doing a very interesting work. Frankly, more interesting than most assistant professors. So if the academic spirit could comment on this, why do they think there is a problem in lack of cloning?
I think we should have him on the panel next time. There may be another reason why this PhD is sort of sought after by students, and it goes back to the statement I made a little bit earlier that a lot of the PhD students are actually foreign students, and there's a cultural value associated with having a PhD degree in many cultures. Frankly, if you came to me and said, you can spend 3 years and we'll give you a degree without a thesis and we'll call it something like a DSc, or you can spend another 6 months and write a thesis and we'll give you a PhD. There isn't much guessing as to which way I go.
Now, especially in systems, PhD people are competing with master's students when they are getting a job. So, what do you see there is that PhD people will continue to be on the top of master's people when they are in a job, or they can go ahead, or it has changed, or has it not changed?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things we notice, Chris. I think the job market has gotten a little better at academic job market a few years ago, but one of the things in systems especially, we noticed, students are taking longer and also doing postdocs or, you know, call it something else. And when they're finally getting to our door to look for an assistant professorship, have many more results, many more papers. And, you know, sometimes in meetings we have to say, oh, that person's been out for 3 years, you know, working in Hennessy's lab, and this person is finishing tomorrow. Gee, maybe that's not fair to compare them, you know, one against the other in terms of maturity, in terms of number of papers. So I think there's a lot of pressure on students to get the good academic jobs, to really do more, stay more in the pipeline, which is just, you know, maybe that's not good, maybe it is, but that's certainly one of the realities that we see in this business. I just one other thing about this whole business that Shimmy's raised about why, you know, the whole PhD system. I mean, if you want to play out, I don't know if anyone's mentioned this, but I mean, the real reason we have PhD candidates at Princeton, I mean, Princeton has a single product that we make, and we're one of the best in the world. You know, Columbia's very good too. And we create undergraduate alums, and it's a huge resource for us, and, you know, we love them, and you know, that's what our business is, to do undergraduates. Without PhD students, we would not have teaching assistants. And there's pressure, there's tremendous pressure, no, you may let, there's tremendous pressure on us to have a PhD program to have students to stay up our classes. If we didn't have an undergraduate program, we'd probably have a lot less PhD students. Or if we didn't have a PhD program, we'd have a lot of trouble staffing our classes. I mean, we pride ourselves only having faculty teach, but, you know, there's still a lot of other infrastructure that's needed to run large classes. And I don't know if it's that different at Rutgers, but I'm sure there's tremendous pressure to have the large PhD program to man your large 6,400 enrollments a year. I mean, you need to do that. So it's, you know, it's great, I like to have people to work with, but the department sees a huge pressure, and I think that's nationally, there's a lot of pressure on us to do that, to make it quality. And you know, unless you're gonna change that, you know, part of the equation, you're gonna have a continual pressure to create lots of PhDs at your departments.
Yeah, if I pay 25,000 a year, you want to use the PhD class.
No, but they do. We always have faculty. I mean, we're, you know, there are a lot of good places that don't do that. But, you know, graders and PAs and, you know, people doing manning terminal rooms. And, you know, all of those things are traditionally, at least in most places, done by our graduate teaching assistants. And we're seeing, you know, more of those available to the department. There's more pressure on us, the department bringing more. We, for example, this fall, we could not man all our teaching slots, which is literally to not have enough graduate students to fill the slots. We had to go across the street to get some E people to help when we wanted to begin the classes. I mean, they're fine, you know, and they're good people, but it's out of our department. I mean, I'm just saying, we could have supported more people. And I'm sure you must have similar things here.